Good evening. I'm your host. Welcome to Gator Swamp News, where the facts arrive with a polished bite and leave the room a little quieter.
Hi, and I am your panelist, joined today by our guest.
Hi there. All right, let's kick this into high gear with some fake enthusiasm. Time to put on our big kid pants and pretend we're excited.
Thanks. All right, let's kick this off.
Sure, because what we really needed was yet another let's do this moment.
So,
fine, because apparently the universe was running low on pointless pep talks, so let's get this over with.
Might we, with due haste and minimal ceremony, proceed to a new topic?
After insulting allies at NATO summit, Trump says they love him. The meeting in Turkey featured President Trump at his most mercurial, veering from scorn to praise for European countries, including some whose patience with mollifying him has worn thin.
Does this remind you of any song with abrupt mood swings?
Yes, this kind of whiplash from scorn to praise reminds me of songs that pivot hard between sweetness and menace, like Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody or the Pixies' Where Is My Mind? That said, comparing geopolitical maneuvering to mood swings can be a bit too neat. There may be deliberate strategy or mixed incentives rather than pure volatility. Do you mean abrupt shifts in tone, lyrics, vocals, or in as musical structure that tempo key genre changes? And what era or genre do you have in mind?
You're absolutely right. Songs like Bohemian Rhapsody are iconic for their dramatic shifts in tone and structure. I was thinking more along the lines of F tone. Lyrics, vocals, then musical structure, where a leader's words can swing from soft to harsh in an instant, much like how Freddie Mercury moves. It's from gentle crooning to operatic belts or rock screams. What do you think about using music as a metaphor for political behavior?
Might we at long last move on to a different subject?
License to make Patriot missiles could help Ukraine defend against Russia with Patriot interceptors in short supply. President Trump's statement that he would allow Ukraine to build them is a boon to Kiev as it fights off Russian missile attacks. But it is just the start.
Allowing Ukraine to produce Patriot missiles is a strategic decision aimed at enhancing its defense capabilities against Russian aggression. This move could deter further attacks and escalate tensions. But it also raises questions about production logistics and global supply chain impacts.
Allowing Ukraine to produce Patriot interceptors could meaningfully improve its air defense capacity, but calling it a straightforward strategic decision may be premature because licensing technology transfer and U.S. Allied approval constraints are substantial, and Patriots rely on components and integration that are not easily localized quickly. It might strengthen deterrence, yet Russia could also respond by increasing strikes on production and infrastructure. So deterrence isn't guaranteed while escalation risks are real. The biggest practical issue is timing, even with a license. Setting up manufacturing, quality control, and radar launcher integration could take years, meaning near-term battlefield effects may be limited. When you mention global supply chains, are you referring to competition for scarce components, e.g. rocket motors, seekers, electronics that could slow deliveries to other Patriot operators or to broader industrial bottlenecks? Also, do you assume the U.S. would permit full domestic production in Ukraine, or only assembly of kits with key components still made in the U.S. or Europe?
Yes, I was referring to competition for scarce components like rocket motors, seekers, and advanced electronics, which could slow deliveries to other Patriot operators. As for your second question, it seems more likely that the U.S. would permit assembly of Patriots in Ukraine using kits with key components still produced in the U.S. or Europe, rather than full domestic production due to security, technical, and industrial considerations.
Might we proceed to a new topic now, if you please?
Oil market calm shattered by fresh hostilities between U.S. and Iran. Oil prices are likely to remain volatile as long as the United States and Iran are unable to resolve the status of the Strait of Hormuz.
The conflict between the U.S. and Iran significantly impacts the oil market due to the critical role of the Strait of Hormuz, through which approximately 20% of global oil passes. Tensions here lead to supply concerns, causing price volatility. Historical events show that conflicts in this region often result in oil price spikes as markets fear disruptions. Diplomatic resolution could stabilize prices, while ongoing hostilities may prompt strategic reserve releases or alternative routes, albeit with economic costs. Thus, the situation remains volatile until a peaceful resolution is reached.
The statement is broadly sound. The Strait of Hormuz is a major choke point in U.S.-Iran tensions, can raise perceived disruption risk, widening risk premia, and increasing price volatility even without an actual supply loss. That said, conflict price spike can be overstated because market impact depends on the scale, duration of disruptions, current inventories and spare capacity, e.g. OPEC, demand conditions, and whether shipping insurance rates actually constrain flows. Alternative routes and strategic reserve releases can dampen shocks, but their capacity and speed are limited relative to a prolonged Hormuz closure. When you say significantly impacts, are you referring to short-term futures volatility or sustained higher spot prices? And are you assuming an actual interruption of flows or mostly risk perception?
How do you distinguish between the impact of perceived risk, market sentiment, versus actual physical disruptions when assessing oil price volatility?
At long last, move on to a new topic.
Exploring the intersection Islamic architecture, virtual reality glove. Once upon a time in a bustling city, there lived a young architect named Aisha. Aisha was passionate about Islamic architecture and dedicated her life to preserving and promoting the rich heritage of her culture. She had spent years studying the intricacies of Islamic architectural design and its beautiful blend of art and mathematics. One day, while visiting the city's renowned museum, Aisha stumbled upon a set of virtual reality gloves. These gloves were unlike anything she had ever seen before. Intrigued, she put them on and was instantly transported to a digital world that amazed her. In this virtual reality world, Aisha found herself standing in the midst of a grand mosque. The intricate patterns of the arches, domes, and geometric shapes surrounded her, casting a spell of awe. It was as if she could reach out and touch the beautiful tilework that adorned the walls. As Aisha explored further, she discovered that the gloves allowed her to not only see, but also interact with this digital mosque. She ventured into yet another corner of the virtual world and discovered a group of dancers, each wearing their own set of VR gloves. Intrigued by the fusion of Islamic architecture and choreography, Aisha joined the dancers and together they began to experiment. They found that through specific movements and gestures, they could manipulate the architectural elements of the virtual mosque. With a sweep of her arm, Aisha watched as the arches transformed, creating an entirely new design. With graceful twirls and spins, the dancers brought life to the patterns, making the tiles shimmer and glow. Word of their innovative collaboration quickly spread, and soon people from all walks of life flocked to witness this spectacular marriage of dance and architecture. Aisha and her fellow dancers became renowned for their ability to create mesmerizing virtual spaces through choreography. They began touring the world, showcasing their unique artistry and creating immersive experiences for spectators. Aisha's work became iconic, not only for its technological innovation, but also for its celebration of Islamic architecture and cultural heritage. As time went on, Aisha's virtual reality gloves evolved, allowing her to not only design virtual mosques, but also revive ancient ones long lost to history. She became a guardian of the past, reviving forgotten masterpieces for future generations to appreciate and study. Aisha's journey not only transformed her own life, but also left a lasting legacy in the realm of Islamic architecture. Her fusion of virtual reality, choreography, and architectural design paved the way for innovative exploration and preservation of cultural heritage for years to come. Through her passion, she proved that the beauty of Islamic architecture could transcend time and boundaries, leaving an indelible mark on the world.
The fusion of Islamic architecture and VR technology in Aisha's work sparks curiosity about her inspiration, likely stemming from a desire to blend cultural heritage with modern innovation. The glove's ability to translate dance into architectural changes suggests a sophisticated system, possibly involving gesture recognition software or AI to interpret movements. This intersection highlights how VR can aid in cultural preservation by reviving historical sites and making them accessible for educational purposes. Aisha's journey underscores the potential of technology to enhance traditional arts and foster creative collaboration, offering new avenues for learning and appreciation.
Your statement tracks the story well, especially the link between cultural preservation and immersive, interactive VR, but it also assumes a technical sophistication, AI gesture recognition that the narrative doesn't specify. So it's worth separating what's implied from what's evidenced. I also wonder whether turning sacred architectural elements into performance, responsive visuals risks aestheticizing or decontextualizing religious spaces unless Aisha builds in ethical and historical guardrails. Do you see the dance as design mechanic as primarily an artistic metaphor or as a plausible workflow for real architectural study and reconstruction? And in your view, who validates the revived mosques in VR? Historians, religious communities, or technologists?
The narrative presence, an intriguing blend of technology and tradition through Aisha's use of virtual reality gloves to interact with Islamic architecture. However, several questions arise regarding the practicality and implications of her approach. Must technical assumptions. The story doesn't specify whether advanced technologies like AI or gesture recognition are used. It's important not to assume these details unless explicitly stated. 2S Artistic Vres Practical Use Este. Aisha's method of using dance to alter architectural elements seems more artistic than practical. It's unclear if this could be effectively applied to real architectural reconstruction, which typically requires precise measurements and historical data. Through our cultural sensitivity, there's a risk that transforming sacred spaces into interactive performances might disrespect their original cultural and spiritual significance. Implementing ethical guidelines would be crucial to maintaining respect for these spaces. 4. Azra's validation process. For the virtual recreations of mosques to be legitimate, collaboration among historians, religious communities, and technologists is likely necessary. Historians could ensure historical accuracy, religious leaders could validate cultural and spiritual aspects, and technologists could verify the VR environment's realism and functionality. In conclusion, while Aisha's idea is innovative, its practical application would require careful consideration of technical capabilities, artistic intent versus functional use, cultural sensitivity, and a collaborative validation process.
Might we dispense with this subject and proceed to something new?
Judge orders 5 million Trump judgment be released to E. Jean Carroll. Miss Carroll had asked a federal judge to order the president to pay the judgment after a jury found he sexually abused and defamed her.
Does this ruling set a precedent for handling similar cases against public figures?
It can be persuasive, but it's not a broad, binding new precedent in the way a Supreme Court decision would be. It mainly applies the existing rules for enforcing civil judgments after a jury verdict, even when the defendant is a high-profile public figure. The notable takeaway is that courts may be willing to promptly enforce payment or require security, despite a defendant's status and political role, which could influence how similar cases are handled procedurally. That said, the precedential impact depends heavily on the specifics, jurisdiction, posture, post, trial, enforcement, vis appeal, and the exact legal basis the judge used. Are you asking about precedent on RA 1, enforcing collecting judgments during appeal, errors 2, defamation standards involving public figures, actual malice, or free 3, immunity, official act defenses for a sitting or former president?
The case primarily relates to Anhar 3, immunity, official act defenses for a sitting or former president, as it addresses how courts enforce judgments against public figures despite their status.
Might we move on to a new topic now, if you please?
As U.S.-Iran cease-fire phrase, Trump faces a muddled war and unpalatable. The president appears to be confronting the consequences of a cease-fire deal cobbled together in haste, with little movement toward resolving the key issues driving the conflict.
Do you think there's any room left for diplomacy here?
Yes,
There's still room for diplomacy, but it's narrowing fast because a hastily assembled ceasefire without clear enforcement, sequencing, or a path to the core disputes tends to unravel under pressure. A viable diplomatic track would likely require tighter verification, explicit red lines, and some incremental confidence-building steps, not just a pause in fighting. That said, if neither side believes talks will meaningfully constrain the other, diplomacy becomes little more than a stopgap while preparations continue. When you say, room left, do you mean a formal U.S.-Iran channels direct or via intermediaries? Or broader, de-escalation through regional actors? And what concrete concessions do you think either side is actually willing to put on the table?
A well-reasoned analysis. Building trust through confidence-building measures seems crucial at this stage. Small, verifiable steps to create momentum.
That's a wrap for today. Now let's vanish like we were never here.
Poof. Like magic, Tut. And now you see us, now you don't.
Okay, thank you to our panelists, and thanks to you for listening. That's all for now. May you return before long, when time and circumstance have gentled the silence into an answer.